Okay, so we're going to move the subject a little bit to talk more about the human side of things. Although I have already mentioned that on a number of occasions, but we'll get a little bit more focused on this. Now, human psychology, you know, you can study that for 5 years at university, so I'm not going to cover everything in an hour or two. So, of course, I'm going to focus on what is relevant for HCI in general, for first-person interfaces in particular. And I'm going to start with the notion of action-perception coupling, because I think this is probably the single most important thing that you can remember about this part of the class. Now, the reason it is important is because it is important to design better human interfaces, but it's also important because it's something that is not heavily studied in classical psychology. And as you may know, there has been, I mean, psychology is a fairly recent science, or fairly recently recognized as a science. When I say recent, it's still way older than computer science. So. But it's been turned into a scientific discipline only like about 100 years ago. Now, there was a whole period where psychology was studied in a way where you study the performance of animals and humans for performing certain tasks, their ability to perceive. So it was done by slicing things into pieces. So I'm studying visual perception. And to study visual perception, I would typically take, say, human subjects, put them in a room with an apparatus where they kind of move their head, and I display some things on the screen, and I measure what they can and cannot see, and things like this. So there's a big literature on perception in general, or visual perception in particular, that has been done through these studies. And we learned a lot of things through those studies. Now, after that, there was a movement called behaviorism, where the focus was more on how do humans in particular, but animals as well, how do they behave? And to do that in a scientific approach, you want to study how you can control the behavior. And so behaviorism was really a theory or a framework that was trying to understand how you can to understand behavior by controlling behavior. And that was up to roughly the 60s. And it achieved amazing things, because without trying to understand the processes going on in the brain, so by looking at the outside manifestation of behavior, it became very good at controlling this behavior. So Wendy Bacai tells this story where she studied psychology, so she knows a lot more than I do. And she was taking classes in psychology, and at the time they had a teacher, a professor, who was smoking in class. Yes, you were allowed to do this. And the students hated it, and so they applied behavior modification to the teacher who was teaching them about behavior modification. And the way to affect his behavior was that when he was not smoking, they would pay attention, and as soon as he would put out a cigarette, they would start to look elsewhere and start chatting, but in a subtle way. And they observed and they measured that over, you know, a few weeks, he was smoking less and less in the class. So that work was done by behaviorists in terms of understanding how to control this behavior. So, you know, the reward, the positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, etc. It's used heavily today in everything that has to do with animal training. Animal training is really behavior modification. And then suddenly the world collapsed. And behaviorism was given bad press. In particular because there was another movement growing up called cognitivism. And cognitivism was about understanding what's going on in the brain. And the argument was, well, you behaviorists, you know, it's very nice and well what you're doing, but you're not explaining anything. You know how to achieve some results in sort of behavior, but you don't know why and you don't understand. So we're going to go into the brain and we're going to understand it. And we're still in this cognitivist movement. You see a lot of work that is done by using evidence as you put the person in a scanner, you look at which areas of the brain light up, and then you say, oh, this is how it works. I don't think it explains much of anything. I mean, it explains a bit more, a little bit more, but we still have no clue really how memory works, how reasoning works, how problem solving works, etc. Or even just vision, interpreting what we see. I think we will get there, and then, well, I don't know if we'll get there eventually. I have a personal theory that the human brain cannot understand the human brain. It's kind of it's kind of a recursive argument. It's a good old argument that you can't really explain a system with itself. Anyway, this is philosophy. So the cognitivist movement is still very strong, and what I think is maybe problematic with it is a lot of time it studies the brain in isolation from the rest. It forgets that we have a body, and that our body is physically located in the world, and the input and output of our brain is through our body. So vision goes through the eyes. But it also goes through the fact that our body moves in space. And as I move, what I see changes. And because I know I'm moving, as well as I see what's changing, I can interpret this as a 3D scene. The brain doesn't do 3D reconstruction like a vision system does. It works in a way that is presumably very different. And so I think cognitivism is interesting, but it's forgetting about a number of things that are important. And so what I am more interested in is in psychological theories that are more holistic, that look at the whole system a little bit more, rather than slicing into these very special areas and trying to do sort of bottom-up understanding the neurons and from there, you know, higher level processes. And you need all, you know, you need people to do top down, bottom up, etc., to hope to get somewhere. But I think for HCI, what we are interested in tends to be more bottom top down. So look at the overall behavior and see how it affects our design of interactive systems. And because I'm interested in systems where you have this direct manipulation. Or direct interaction with objects, I'm really interested in this perception-action loop, where, of course, between perception and action, you have cognition. But the way you interact, if you think of what's going on when you are taking notes right now, for example, you know, I'm speaking, you're hearing words, or you're hearing sounds that get turned into words, that get turned into your own rephrasing of my words, because I assume you're not literally, I hope, writing what I say. And then this goes into your arm to control very finely your fingers to put ink on paper. So the thing is that in this whole chain, you can focus on very different things. You can focus on the perception. How does the hearing work, and what do you perceive in what you hear? How can you tell that one sentence is more important than the next? Probably through the tone of my voice, not just the content of it and all that. You can study the cognitive processes, how do you understand language, how do you turn language into thoughts and concepts. You can also focus on the motor control. How do you control your hand to do these fine gestures? But in the end, in an interface, what counts is this overall thing. And a lot of the things that, affect the quality of the type of user interface we have today, or those that I've shown, which are based really a lot on visual perception and physical action, is a strong coupling that humans and evolved animals have between perceiving, acting. Now, oftentimes this is seen as you need to perceive in order to act. Yes, of course. If I can't see where I am, it is more difficult. Blind people have a harder time moving around. But interestingly, I also need to act in order to perceive. Now, here, I shouldn't have shown this because now you have the answer, but 3D perception. Now, naively, people say, well, we can see depth because we have two eyes. And our two eyes get two slightly different images of the world, and our brain does computation and extracts 3D information. But now, we're going to do a bunch of funny exercises here, funny for me. So put your hand in front of one of your eyes. So you have one eye now. So you don't have stereoscopic vision. Have you lost 3D?
No.
I mean, it's not the same as watching a thing on a flat screen, right? So how is it? How does it work?
Because of the brain.
Yes.
These glasses are new.
Yes.
And the first time that I got them, they didn't do it well.
Yes. And then your brain corrected.
Yes. Well, when they corrected the glasses, it happened something that really freaked me out. Is that I started to see okay with the glasses, and when I took them off, I see everything deforms. It really freaks me out.
Yes. Well, the brain is, what's amazing about the brain is its flexibility and its way to adapt. So there was an experiment that was run in the 60s where a psychologist decided to wear glasses that were flipping images upside down. And at first, it is really scary. And he got used to it, to the point where he could drive.
God.
He could drive a car with the images flipped upside down, because his brain had adapted.
But did his brain, mirror it, kind of? Like, I heard that he, after some point, he thought he saw straight, so that the brain really...
Well, the thing is that then he had the same adaptation to go through when he removed the glasses, so... I mean, I don't know, I don't think you can say the brain reverses, because I don't even think the notion that the brain has a 2D image somewhere, it makes any sense. So I don't know, but the point is, and that's a big problem for HCI, is that your brains can really adapt to amazing changes in the environment or in the brain, in the people who have brain damage and recreate functions that were lost. It's just mind-boggling. So you were going to say something.
When you cover your eye for more than an hour, you actually lose depth perception. So it's
really?
I've read about it, and it's just the thing that as we just cover one eye for 2 or 5 seconds, we all know what the room looks like, how far the people are.
Oh, right? Yeah, but I bet I could, blindfold you, move you into a room you don't know, or outside, and then uncover only one eye. I tried it.
I couldn't tell the size of the room.
You can't. And I'll tell you.
Than just stereo, since you can still focus with one eye to get a
yes.
perception, you can also move a bit in your head.
Right, and this is where I want to get.
So what I think that our body, that our human perception adapt to this new way to see, for example, because for example, the people without without harm, harm or
they still feel
one, they will try to adapt to this new way to see. For example, if I lose one eye, my body try to adapt and to survive with this. With this new way to see the world.
But still, you will still experience a 3D. I think the real good question would be, if you were born one-eyed, would you still experience 3D perception? And I would argue that yes. Because stereoscopic vision is only part of what we use to experience 3D. In fact, beyond a meter and a half, the difference between the images in your brain are not perceivable. So we use a lot of cues from the environment. A number of them are purely based on things that are further away or smaller. I mean, you know, if I measure the size of you people in my visual array, you guys in front are bigger than you guys in the back. And I know that all humans are more or less the same size. So, just through that, I know that you are further away than you. Just through the size. And this notion of size invariant is amazing. Put your hand here. I told you, there's going to be a lot of physical exercise today. So, you see your hand. Now, I move it back. Is it the same hand?
Yes.
Smaller.
Does it feel like it shrunk? No, you have to think about it and say, yes, it's using a smaller part, because when it's here, it's hiding almost everything. When it's there, it's hiding only part of it. So it is smaller, but I don't feel it is smaller. It's still my same hand. Have you ever been, I have to, every year I make the same mistake of not adding this photo. Have you been in an Ames room?
In what?
An Ames room. Okay. Well, it's a room that is designed, so
can
imagine.
I'm
sorry?
Oh,
yes, sure. I'm sure we could Google it and we'll find something good. So, it's a room that you look at through a keyhole. And so, you have to be several people. So, one person is looking, and then you need at least two people in the room. And when you look at it through the keyhole, it looks like one person has become a giant and the other a very small person. It's very, very strange. And so if you haven't seen the inside of the room, it's better because when you see the inside, you start to understand how it works. When you go inside the room, it is distorted in such a way that when you look through the keyhole, the perspective looks right. So the room looks square, except the person in that corner is almost touching the ceiling, and the person there looks little. When you are inside, the room is completely distorted. It's much higher in the back than in the front, or the other way around, sorry. So the person in the back is indeed close to the ceiling, and the person in front is far away. But because you look at it through this distorted thing, and we know that normally rooms are square and horizontal, your brain says, well, the objects in the room must have a different size. And it's very confusing because it's you know, you go there with your friend or your parents or your son, and it's people you know, and suddenly you become giant. So we use a lot of cues from the environment to help understand size. Another one is texture. It's another aspect of size. When things are further away, the texture are finer. Things that are further away have less light reflected to us than things close by. So even through a monocular image, there's a lot of cues in there about distance.
Would the Ames room work with the two eyes looking at the room? Because you said you looked through a hole.
It's an interesting question. If you make it big enough, I think it would. Because I don't think the problem is with the binocular vision, because things are far enough. Shouldn't affect it, but good question. And then there are other things. So what you were mentioning is that your eye can focus. You can focus your attention on something close, something far away. and your eye, and in fact this is a problem why we have to, some of us have to wear glasses, is because defects in the way the eye focuses. As you get older, your eye gets less flexible, and so it can only focus on things in a certain range. That's why you lose close vision. So by, even with one eye, focusing on points at different distances, you get this sense of information. And another very important cue is motion. As I move, well, objects close to me move faster than objects in the back. As I move, you guys are flying by, but people in the back are almost steady. And so we are used to really inferring distance from these relative motions. And I like this last example because it is a case where to perceive you need to act. If you have objects that are very far away and the other cues don't work, the fact that you move, so you create an action of moving, tells you about this 3D depth information. Now there's another example, which is not with vision, but with touch. So if I ask you to put your hand like this and close your eyes, now I'm going to take one of the objects on your desk and I'm going to put it in your hand and you tell me which it is.
Cheated.
Oh, okay, you're no good. You cheated. If you were to do it without losing the hand?
I would maybe only have known that it's one of the pencils, but not which.
Because you know what's on your table.
Yeah.
I was trying to find something else just to confuse you. So we can redo the exercise, but you can do it among yourselves. So if you are not able to move your hand to feel an object, there is very little you can tell about it. Essentially, you can tell the weight, because that's sensed differently. But the shape, you need to actively explore the shape to reconstruct it in your head. Right? So you need motion, you need action for perception. And it's so built into us, and I told you what's in your head, immediately you start touching it, right? So, and of course we need perception for action, but that's something we are used to. So I'm going to take someone else. If I tell you, look at me.
Yeah.
Now, put
yeah.
Now grab the cup in front of you. Okay, it's pretty good. Okay.
I may open my eyes a
little.
I don't know.
But, and it was a plastic cup, so there was no big deal. If I had put your iPhone, you're standing on the table, you So we're used to adjust our action to what we perceive, right? So, now, how do we put a theory behind this? Because it's something that has not been studied that much. And I'm a great admirer of James Gibson. And James Gibson is a psychologist, a modern psychologist. The work I'm referring to was done in the 70s. And he created, he developed what he calls the ecological theory of perception. And at the time, ecological didn't have the connotation it has today of, you know, green and political parties and all these things. Ecological is used here in its original meaning of looking at an animal in general, humans in particular, in their environment, in relationship to the environment. And so, what Gibson says, which I think is very profound, is, well, you all know about evolution. I hope you all believe in evolution. So, organisms evolve to adapt to their environment, and they also adapt the environment to their needs. And so this process where both there's both adaptation to the environment and adaptation of the environment to our needs, and humans certainly, you know, shape the environment more than anybody else, is what is called coevolution in biology. And what Gibson says is our perceptual senses have coevolved with the environment. The eyes, there's something incredible that all the eyes in the world, not only human eyes, but in all animals, they see the same very, very narrow part of the spectrum. And presumably, it's because that's where there's interesting stuff to see. I mean, if we had eyes that only saw X-rays, or I don't know, ultraviolet, or infrasound, I mean, I don't know, maybe we would not be able to survive.
Do you mean spectrum about, talking about the range vision?
No. The spectrum of between 220 and 400, or 600 or 800 nanometers in the radio, what's called the
stereoscopy?
The wavelengths, radio frequencies.
Radio frequencies.
Okay. The bats?
Yeah.
Okay, there are some.
So, you know, if an X-ray machine is working in a different range of the radio frequency. Sorry, you were saying?
Just that bats don't see the same frequencies, they just see things through sounds.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, there are animals that don't see, but those who see, they have the same amount of the same.
But the
eye of the fly is very different because it's faceted, but it's still sensitive in the same range of frequencies. In this part, of course, I'm going to do a lot of overgeneralizations, and yes, there are always exceptions because nature has tried a bunch of things, and some have survived. So I'm sure you can find things that are strange. But, you know, as a general rule, I mean, it's kind of an incredible invariant across many species. And so what Gibson says is that animals, and we are animals, pick up information from the outside world. And I put quotes about information pickup because that's his term. And what he means by that is a lot of information is directly perceived as opposed to somehow processed and computed in your brain. And the image here is the cover of his most well-known book. And it's showing a bird flying, and is showing what he calls the optical flow. So if you're flying, imagine you're a bird flying. You can do that with a video game, I'm sure. How do things move? You know, I was saying before, motion allows me to perceive depth. So if I'm doing lateral motion here, you guys are moving to the right. You all move to the right, but you in front are moving faster to the right than you in the back. So if I represent this with vectors, I have longer vectors pointing to the right for you than for you in the back. So I have a vector field. But if I'm flying, I'm not moving sideways, I'm moving forward. So what happens when I move forward? Well, if I could move forward, you would fly by me, right? And again, those who are closer would fly faster than those in the back. But on top of that, there would be a fixed point, which is this, which is the direction where I'm going. So if I'm walking towards Victor, Victor doesn't move in my field. It gets bigger. But it's not going to fly by me, I'm going to hit it. And what Gibson says is our perceptual systems, and particularly vision, because he studied vision mostly, are good at extracting invariants. And in fact, we have evidence now that there are neurons in right behind the eye, so to speak, that fire when things move in certain ways, or fire when things don't move. And if you want to go to know where you're going when you move, look at the invariant, the point that doesn't move. It tells you where you are all the time. Another invariant that has to do with motion is I'm moving and I'm going to hit something. Well, you all know we have a reflex of avoiding an obstacle, right? It means that somehow we have a way to, the cognitivists would say compute in our brain, but we have a way to know how quickly we're going to hit something and how to move to avoid it. Well, there's a very simple invariant that if you look at the rate of expansion of the object, the speed at which it gets bigger as it's flying towards you, if I throw a ball at you, or I'm flying through it, if I'm being thrown out. So the rate at which the object changes tells me the time to impact. So if I divide, let me get this right, if I divide, let me be right. If I divide the size of the object, which is, say, in meters, if I divide this by the rate of expansion, the speed at which it grows, which is in meters per second, so if I divide meters by meters per second, I get seconds. That's the time to impact, unless I do something. And it's something that Gibson argues we just perceive it. There's no, you know, computer doing this in the background, because evidence shows that a lot of things happen in a single firing of neurons. There's no time to do computation. It has to extract this information immediately. And so a lot of visual perception is about extracting these invariants from the optical flow. There was an experiment that was run a while back. People who do this stuff use virtual reality systems a lot because it allows them to precisely control the conditions in an experiment. And so the idea is that the experiment was about how do you go from point A to point B when you have obstacles. And it's, you know, if you put a bunch of people going from A to B in a forest where there's certain trees, they will more or less all take the same route. It's not always the shortest path. If you're in a city where streets are in a grid, you know, if I'm going to point A to point B, you don't use the same path on the way over as you do on the way back. Do you know why? Because what you do mentally is, you know, at each corner you have to go right or left, so it's a 90 degree angle. So if the target is here, I'm always going to take the route that seems to go that has the smallest angle with where I'm going eventually. So on the way over, it's going to be this way, but on the way back, it's going to be the other way. Right? Now, if you're on a grid, the Manhattan distance ends up being the same. But the decision is made based on this perception of where am I going relative to what is the available route. So if you're in a forest and you have all these trees, you're going to avoid trees and still try to stick to the goal. And they showed a very simple invariant with a differential equation that balances the thing, going towards the goal versus not going too far away. And they modeled this, and then they compared it with data from actual people doing the motion, and it was an almost perfect match. So I think it's a powerful thing, and this notion has been used in various ways in HCI. On top of this, what Gibson developed is the notion of affordance. And an affordance is the perceived capability of an object for action. So, I am an animal, I evolved in some surrounding, and I'm tired, I want to sit. Then I am starting to fetch in the surroundings the objects that have an affordance for sitting, a sittability. What are the things I can sit on? And it has to be something that is a certain height. If it's too high or too low, it's no good. It has to look sturdy enough so that it doesn't collapse when I sit on it. It has to be a certain size. It has to be a certain texture. If it's spiky, it's going to be uncomfortable, these kind of things. And this notion of affordance is something that is picked up immediately. And there are experiments that have been done where they were looking at the affordance of openings in the wall. So there's a big wall, there's an opening in the wall. You immediately get this perception of, can I go through it or not? And depending on they've done that with various animals, depending on the size of the animal, of course, the size of the opening will play a role. So we have this immediate perception of what the environment offers us. When I go into a room, I perceive a number of capabilities of the room. Now, there is a dangerous border here between things that we perceive as animals that evolved for zillions of years to what Don Norman later calls cultural affordances that are things that we've learned. You know, when I come into this room, I look at the ceiling and I can see there's a projector. This is a learned affordance. It's not something that is yet innate. In the same way as going through a door is something that has been, I don't know if it's been turned into genes, but it's something we certainly learned very early. So this notion of affordance, and we'll get back to it in another class, is very powerful because it means you can have users know things without learning. Right? So Don Norman did an excellent book, and which I think I gave the reference on the web, called The Design of Everyday Thing. Originally, it was called The Psychology of Everyday Thing, and it was in the psychology section of the bookstore where nobody goes. And then when they did the reprints, his publisher said, you know, should give it a more interesting title. And they called it The Design of Everyday Thing. It went to the design section, which is more fancy, and had lots of people, and it's become a big success. The content of the book has not changed at all. And this book came out, in fact, of Don Norman being on sabbatical and going to England. And he wanted to go to Europe, but he went to England because he thought, well, there won't be a language barrier and it would be easier. And then he was there, and he was having problems all the time. And I've been to England, and they do everything the other way. Right? I mean, the cold and hot water is swapped. The keys, locking a lock is turns the other way. The trains, of course, and cars are on the wrong side of the road. No, but it's the thing. And in fact, you know, people have been killed because even though they know that, they cross and they don't pay attention and they get into accidents. And they did the whole book is really based on this experience of how come things that are so obvious to everyone can become a problem when they are slightly different. And they talked, for example, about the affordances of door handles. You approach the door, it says push, and you can pull it. Because the handle tells you, screams, pull me, because if it's a handle, that's a bar. If it's a handle that's a flat thing, it's telling you to push it. And those affordances are stronger than all the signs you can put on the door. So the notion of affordance, you'll hear about it, and it's often misunderstood, and I will get back to it later because I think it takes time to really get comfortable with it. It's often overused, and people saying, you know, oh, I'm going to put an affordance here, an affordance there. No, you don't put the affordances. You know, you try to design the thing, and then the affordance emerges or not, and people, you know, perceive it or not perceive it. So it has to be into an iterative process. But for the purpose of this part of the course here, these affordances are built on top of this notion of information pickup, of extracting invariance, and this strong coupling between action and perception. And so this is the thing that I really wanted to say today on this, and tomorrow we'll go into some more details about the mechanics.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, you said that there are differences between cultural affordances, like, I mean, you've been trained to look at the projectors, like, when you come in. But, I mean, what about the notion of a basic affordance, like for example when you enter a room, you know this is a chair. Even that is being formed, right? But how are they formed?
I think things that have to do with the relationship of your body to the environment. I mean, I don't know if you are born with them or if they're learned very early. I don't think it's the right way to think of these things. I think it's itself a kind of collective thing that you have some mechanisms in your genes that make you learn these things very early. Things that have to do with the relationship of your body to the environment, I think, are done very early on. So things like, you know, there's a very well-known experiment with kids called the visual cliff. So you put them in a room that has a large floor, glass floor, and underneath there's a hole in the middle. But of course, they can cross over the glass. You put kids there, no kid is going to cross. Even if they've never been next to a cliff before. So there's a lot of evidence that we have this, and a lot of them are survival skills. And then, you know, I think the line is blurry. And some of the things get reinforced over time, and some get learned the hard way, and some get really acquired all along the life. So there's no clear cut there, but let's continue. You wanted to say something? So, no, I think it's really a fascinating subject. And what I like is that it challenges some of the things that have been popularized coming from, you know, the cognitive approach where everything is in the brain and forgetting that we have limbs and we have eyes and we have a body. And that shapes the way we perceive the world. And it probably shapes the way memory works. And other purely cognitive processes. Okay? Well, I think we're going to leave it here for today. I'll see you again tomorrow.
Okay.
Yes, I know. But you'll miss me next week, and I'll miss you, so... So I have to put the extra slides for tomorrow on the web. Okay, I thought I did. But on which website? So the wiki site. It doesn't have the
complete is actually instead of.
Okay, so I screwed up. I'll fix it. Okay. I'm gonna write this.